Well, hello, good afternoon, Failcha, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on the CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, and once again in the bunker, overcoming certain technical difficulties to bring this show to you. I just wanted to mention off the top, should our over-the-air go down and you are listening to it, you can always catch up with our show as it is dumped straight to our archive. Go to CFRU.ca if you ever miss a beat or if you want to hear something again for the first time. And joining me on the line, of course, as usual, our chief assignment editor and the Guelph Politico himself, Adam A. Donaldson. Adam, are you there?
Well, I'm here.
Oh, excellent. Good, good. I'm glad everything's lining up. So that's fantastic. Anyway, full slate once again this week. As we had a guest lined up, but they couldn't make it. So we're going to talk about the situation in the press gallery in Alberta. A bit of a row going on there, and we'll get into that, do a bit of a deep dive, or a shallow dive. New Brunswick is having an election in the middle of a pandemic, which should be interesting and also unprecedented, and everything that goes with that, it's going to be an interesting one. I don't know if the New Brunswick election normally is super exciting, but this one is going to be wild and weird. Democratic National Convention this week, as you've probably seen, a virtual convention, also unprecedented. A lot going on there. But off the top, speaking of a lot going on, Adam, quite the week this week in Ottawa. We've got Bill Morneau's resignation, Chrystia Freeland called up from Deputy Prime Minister, right? The government shut down due to a prorogue, which was a bit of a surprise, and Pierre Poilievre throwing stuff around. Throwing blacked out sheets. I don't know how much he spent on printer toner this week, but, you know, it's impossible to use a PDF as a prop and throw your phone around. So you had to print off sheets of paper and just lob them. I don't know if you saw any of that, but it was pretty funny. I don't think he did make some good points, but hilarity ensued with that one.
Right. It was like, I remember way back in the day, Howard Hampton, who was the NDP leader before Andrea Horvath during the, I think it was the 2003 election.
Yeah.
He was doing a lot of stunt campaigning. And one of the things he did was he had like a big flatbed truck with a big sack on it with a money sign on it to show how much, you know, money that the Harris Eves government had wasted. I can't even remember what exactly the point was he was trying to make, but I remember the stunt.
Yeah.
And I think this is what, you know, Pierre Poilievre, I don't think anyone really knows what he was talking about, but they know that he was throwing around a lot of finger quotes and throwing
yeah,
a lot
just
of
like,
pages.
Redacted. It was in the episode of The Office or redacted. Everything was like, that's what it reminded me of. Kind of like
right,
The Office, which is paper.
I joked on Twitter. It was more like Bennett Brower, who is a character that Chris Farley did on Saturday Night Live on the Weekend Update. He would be brought in to do commentary, and then he would start talking about things that were said about him, and he'd be using finger quotes very, very liberally.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, I remember.
Unfortunately, you can't find the YouTube clip because it is not on YouTube. It's very hard to find some of those great, really '90s sketches from Saturday Night Live because I find them so apt at times, but. I mean, to behind the finger quotes, I mean, there is like some really serious stuff going on, which it was a whole domino effect. Morneau came out and said that he was stepping down because he totally was always going to only do two rounds as an MP.
Yeah, even though this round just started.
Right. It was
just started very recently.
But he has this really, really great opportunity to be the Secretary General of the Operation for Economic Cooperation and Development. So, you know, I'm not sure how that's a better gig than being the finance minister of the country, but apparently it is.
Is that gig even available? That was my question. Is like he's applying for this job that may or may not be open.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like a really convenient scapegoat slash excuse slash reason.
Well, it's better than more time with the family, I suppose. A bit more creative, right? And we're going to go to Kenya with, but no, maybe not these days.
Right. It is better than the old family because you know, nobody ever believes that one.
Yeah, well, like, I guess because his family
are more time with my family. It's like we've been locked down for months, but that's just still not enough time.
And they're directly involved with the scandal, so maybe they did have to come up with something different. Actually, that's really what he wants to do, right? Fall on the sword and then, you know, go apply for a job.
And this is it. There's been some interesting reporting that there's been some back and forth between the Trudeau camp and the Morneau camp. Trudeau has been kind of teeing up that Bill Morneau is going to go under the bus for this. And understandably so, because there was that $41,000 that he had to write the check for the morning of his testimony.
Yeah.
There was the private plane ride to Kenya, as you were alluding to, while he was a sitting MP at that. And that is a definite no-no.
Yes.
In terms of what MPs are allowed to do, only very specific circumstances are you allowed to fly private as an MP.
Because just to be clear, the Morneau McCains are really, really wealthy. Like they don't need to expense anything, right?
To quote a famous president of the United States, they're like really, really rich.
Really, really rich. Yeah, like one percenters. So 41K is nothing to the guy. And I think it was CBC described his approach as even-handed detachment. But in some ways, to me, it always seemed like almost pure detachment. He was just kind of blasé. You know, like, I wrote the check this morning. And
I was totally looking for this receipt for $41,000, and I couldn't find it. So I just had to, cut a check again.
It's in France in the villa somewhere in the change drawer.
Which is something like regular people totally have experiences with. Like, I could have swore I had this receipt for $41,000 lying around, but it's not in the shoebox.
It's been redacted, so I had to know how much it was.
Yeah, it's and then, as you were saying, Chrystia Freeland is now the finance minister, which is like further adding to her portfolio. And there was a political cartoon I saw where it's her juggling deputy prime minister, now the finance department. I think she's also she's an intergovernmental liaison. That was like one of her kind of original gig when the government came to power, is like coordinating between the federal government and the provinces. So now she has these like three big jobs, and the political cartoon was her juggling them. And I think it was like a safe, a piano, and something else that was really, really heavy, just to show how much of a burdens kind of fell on her to clean up after the boys on this.
Chrystia the fixer. That's right. That seems to be her job. Like, just because she'll do it, no problem.
I know Chrystia Freeland will stick about.
Yeah, that's right. Because she's so quiet. There's some question as to her finance qualifications. She was a Rhodes Scholar, right, and a very seasoned political person. So, she, and what was the Thomson Reuters, right? She ran Thomson Reuters and, of course, negotiated the NAFTA deal, too. So she's not like completely green. Isn't it just say, OK, just get Chrystia to do it because she's doing everything? I mean,
on top of that, though, it's not like the finance minister literally sits there with a calculator adding up all
the adding machine with a ka-chunk. Yeah, but then the finance minister is really the right hand person, right? I mean, they always say the deputy prime minister is one thing, but traditionally, it's the finance minister who they're neck and neck. Think of Chrystia and Paul Martin when they were getting along. You know, like that. It is really the second seat, mm-hmm. other than mm-hmm. deputy PM. So, and a little bit of a, well, I've heard reset, relaunch, retooling, refocus. Anything that starts with a re is what the prorogue is supposed to accomplish. It's not a super long one. I mean, it's September 23rd, but considering we are still in the middle of the crisis. Now, that's not to say that the business of government will stop, but mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting move. Polyev, who is, I think people know how I feel about that guy, but when he's saying, cover-up may be a bit extreme, but it did sort of, I think the attempt is to make it cool down and go away a bit. But it was funny coming from Polyev because when the Harper prorogue, prorogues, because there was more than pierogi, I don't know what the plural is, there was a march downtown over that one. And
that was in 2010, I think.
Yeah, and at the time, Pierre was like, There's a poll that suggests that people don't really care. They're not too interested in the proroguing. So, wow, what a difference a decade makes. Hey, you just change it up completely. It's like, oh, this is an outrage and this is a scandal. And yeah, it is. But due to that scandal, there's been a serious, serious shuffle. And they've said, okay, well, we need to reset using the...
That was a great Nixon impression of Pierre Poilievre, though.
he is not a crook.
but you're right. It is... pot calling the kettle black on this, but I mean it's not unfair either, because Trudeau ran on 2015, you know, on this idea that Stephen Harper liked to use pirogue to get himself out of political jams, and it's true, he did.
Yep.
One of the I think that the one we were talking about there, where there was marching in the downtown core, and not just in Guelph but in other places. Mm-hmm. That was after the government was found to be censured by violating the rules of parliament. They were given a parliamentary censure. Mm-hmm. Which is the first time that had ever happened, and Harper was like, okay, we'll shut it down and
reset.
When you guys have calmed down, we'll come back and do the nation's business. And people were out in the street on it, understandably so, and we're kind of back there again. And what's good for Harper is bad unless you need to use this sort of extreme tool. And here and Justin Trudeau can flower it up all he wants when he says, like, we just need to take a second and reset our priorities because of the pandemic. And you're like, please, the stuff's getting too hot. You got 5,000 pages of semi-redacted documents that you've got to dump. You don't want to talk about it anymore. It's late summer. You know, Labor Day's almost here. You're just going to put this in a drawer until late September, and then we'll roll out a throne speech, and, you know, hopefully everyone will, like, chill the heck out after this. And it's not a particularly old political dodge, but the fact that Trudeau is using it is again, another kind of, you know, black smudge. Not to infer, you know, anything about Trudeau's past wearing black smudges, but
right.
it's a black mark on a record that was supposed to be very different from the Harper years, and we're kind of right back to almost like the most basic of tools from the Harper years, which is proroguing, because he did it 4 times in 9 years.
Yeah, and it used to just be a procedural thing. It was like, well, you know, there's only a week left. Let's just wrap this up, I think. And then it became a tool, to like a heavy-handed tool in some cases. And I would say definitely in this case, as I'd said about everything that is going on. So, yeah, Freeland's got our work cut out for considering everything's going on, not just the crisis itself, but the disputes that are going on, China, the U.S., like the two big partners, we're having issues. U.S. is aluminum, and China is, well, virtually everything, including the Michaels. Yeah. So, which isn't just a finance issue, but she's, you know, has a lot on. I guess she's going to have some time to strategize. But I briefly saw something before airtime today. They made some changes to CERB and whatnot. Did you see anything about that? It sounded like they've already...
there was an announcement today that I did not get a chance to follow up on.
Thursday's always such a busy day, you know. It's like so much happens before airtime, so we're already like.
I feel compelled to once again, though, to point out at the end of the day, there have been a lot of people online who were like, "Oh, it's just, you know, they were trying to help out people. Everyone chill out," and.
I mean, like liberal apologists or just everybody?
Yeah, well, liberal apologists especially. And, yeah. I understand that in terms of like the great, like when you look at stuff going on in the United States, and we're going to get there in a second, you know, having a nonprofit administer $1 billion in money for young people because the people who lead that charity and the people who lead our government are muy simpatico. That seems like rather penny ante in terms of political scales, but there are really deeply serious questions about how much, whose idea was it? It seems that the government hasn't been entirely truthful about how this came about. The We Charity has not been entirely truthful about how this came about. It seems like there was kind of an echo chamber where We came out and said, hey, we have this cool idea for like a program And Bart of Chagger's office was saying, well, we're kind of working on this other program. And then Wee comes back and says, hey, maybe we could do that program. And there seems to be kind of this back and forth, self-sustaining, perpetual motion of a scandal as this program was developed. But at the end of the day, the Parliamentary Budget Office says that you know, giving UBI, Universal Basic Income, to every Canadian would have cost about $96 million on the outside edge for about 6 months. CERBUS costed $73 million. So we have a government jumping through these hoops to find a way to not give Universal Basic Income to people during the pandemic, as sort of like a last ditch resort, when it turns out, you know, just for an extra $20 million, it could have been done, and we could have avoided this whole thing about giving contracts to We Charity to begin with.
Yes. So, once again,
that was a long way to get.
Yeah,
there.
No, that was a good wrap up there. But yeah, so much going on here, and we will definitely get back to that. And I don't know if that'll be after the prorogue, probably. But yeah, anyway, Ottawa is always on our radar. And speaking of on the radar, I love that your post there. Run DNC. DNC are definitely running with it this week in Milwaukee. Although Milwaukee is virtually empty, it is really strange seeing people trying to cover this virtual convention. Making a point of going to Milwaukee and still going through the motions, pretty much. There was that picture of that lone guy at somebody's, I think it might have been when Kamala Harris was accepting. It is strange, but it rolls on, and it's getting a certain amount of coverage. I don't like this. Used to be, though, I think what's unprecedented is this used to be the type of event where people would sit down and watch it, and they spoke to, I think, the longest. The Democrat who's been to the most conventions. I think she started going in the 50s as a young woman. I've never missed one. And suppose she's got like a TV in every room and she's trying to follow it. But the way it's presented is different. And who was it made the point the other day? I think it was David Frum, interestingly, was talking about how all of these things are going to be sort of parceled out and targeted to certain audiences, Democrats and others. So it kind of moves beyond just the standard convention and becomes sort of, you know, the targeted things that we see in the modern era, like this will go to the South, this will go to the women in the party, this will go to whoever. I was like, yeah, that's a really good point. Like this is a completely different game now, isn't it?
Yeah, the convention was always kind of going this way. It's always been kind of like for the last several cycles, it's been very pageant-like, where it's about who gets the great speaking slots, like who gets to speak on Monday as opposed to who gets to speak on Wednesday.
Who gets 60 seconds like AOC.
How long you get, you know, who's leading into you and things like that. And I mean, to have the virtual convention like this, where it is treated very much like a show, they are executing this kind of award show where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are kind of coronated as the nominees for the Democratic Party. Having said that, I think it works better. I think it's one of these things that, like when they didn't have a host for the Oscars for the first time, and people are like, oh no, like how's the show going to work without a host? It turns out the show works actually better without a host.
Good
or
flow.
At least without like a mediocre host, or, you know, because, you know, a good host is one thing, but having a host like James Franco, who is barely taking part, is phoning it in, right? But you know, the things like on Tuesday night, I've watched it every night.
Oh,
and on Tuesday night when they did the roll call, which is, you know, when every the delegates from every state and every territory announce to whom their delegates are going to, and it was kind of this like travelogue of different people. You know, some of them were politicians, some of them were just regular folks, some of them were like Matthew Shepard's parents. Matthew Shepard, who was who was killed in Wyoming, I want to say 96. It was a hate crime. It was one of like the first like really highly publicized hate crimes against a queer person. Mm-hmm. They announced who the Wyoming delegates were going to. You had what's his name? Kamir Khan, who was the father of the Gold Star soldier who spoke at the Democratic Convention in 2016 and who was promptly attacked by Donald Trump. He announced the Virginia delegates. So you had this like really rich kind of different flavors from different places, different people. And it was all done in like 20 to 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. And instead of like this whole going around the stadium or the arena or wherever this takes place in, and you know, all the applauding and it was more of a show, but it also kind of felt less showy. It feels like we kind of get things done watching this as opposed to a bit of a slog like some of these conventions are usually. I've enjoyed it more this year, I think.
Yeah, and it's definitely one for the modern era and precedent setting as well. And some of the speakers too, like Michelle Obama coming out, sounds like she stole the show, but I think it's hard to steal the show now, really, with the way it's set up. How did who described it? It was PBS described it as an infomercial meets We Are the World. And I was like, yeah, if you're old enough to know what We Are the World is, yeah, PBS directly targeted it.
I think that's a fair comparison.
There
is a definite infomercial quality to it, especially with they pause every now and then to say, hey, text, you know, join to whatever number you text to, and then you can like give us money to help us, you know, fight the good fight. But, you know, as I've said, this is kind of the way it's been going for a while with, you know, showing off who's going to be a future star. Here's the stars of the past. Here are our past presidents. Here are our past first ladies. Here's what we're going to do. And
Billie Eilish and the usual Hollywood musical music types.
And, so it's all there, but I feel like there's a certain pageantry that has been taken away that can be draining. And instead we just get the straight up electioneering and the straight up show with, you know, hitting the different speeches. And you also have hosts. There have been hosts for the various nights, and they've been celebrities. Eva Longoria was the host on Monday night. Tracy Ellis Ross from Black-ish was the host of Tuesday. And then last night, Kerry Washington hosts. Mm-hmm. And I think tonight, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Veep herself, is the MC. So.
Well, I mean, and that's how to get people to watch, right? For sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, where was it going to go with that? Oh, yeah, and there's Republicans making appearances. This may be also unprecedented as well. Who is Cindy McCain, right?
Yeah.
John McCain's widow, Colin Powell.
Colin Powell endorsed Biden on Tuesday, yeah.
John Kasich, has he been yet, or is that coming, or did that happen?
John Kasich was on Monday. There was kind of like a Republican segment where it was there were other Republicans, too, who had like sort of small like endorsement pieces, like, I'm also going to vote for Joe Biden, not Donald Trump. And that led into the Kasich speech, which was literally done at a fork in the road, which
was standing out at the crossroads. I didn't see it. Sorry.
It was a little on the nose.
Oh, yeah. Let's club you over the head with a metaphor, because you might not get it. No, I think
people, exactly.
I think people are getting it. And the televisions are so good now; they're so big. I'm sorry, I don't want to Trump voice there for some reason. I don't know why, because that'd be his analysis. Oh, it looked beautiful.
Well, speaking of Trump's analysis, he went off the handle after Obama's speech last night.
Yeah, well, I did see it, but I didn't see a bit of that on Twitter, but that was trending on Twitter. He went off on Obama saying they stole from us, or what was the phrase again?
I wrote it down. He said, in all caps, he said, he spied on my campaign and got caught.
Yeah, because that's right. And got caught was trending on Twitter, right? And I was like, what the heck is the and got caught? And of course, Trump has gotten caught in a lot of things. And as a bit of an aside, because it's an evolving story about Bannon today getting caught, scamming money over, what was it, We Build the Wall?
It was a crowdfunding effort to raise funds to help build that odious that border wall.
The private chunk of wall, right? And of course, Trump is disowning, I hardly knew him, and I hardly knew anything about this. And then there's a thing of Don Jr. making the rounds, like congratulating all the We Build the Wall people. And You know, saying this is what capitalism is all about. Anyway, we digress, but that's, yeah, significant. Like, talk about getting caught. I don't know him at all.
Well, it's terrible timing because, you know, as a lot of the convention so far has been making the case about Trump's inadequacies as a manager, someone who's like been stewarding the country through a three-pronged crisis, the public health one, the economic one, the social justice one, his inadequacies. I mean, Barack Obama, this is probably the line that set Trump off. He said that Donald Trump has no interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves.
And also saying he didn't respect the office. What do you say? He didn't appreciate the weight of the office and how serious it was. And that was. Yeah, Obama obviously made some pretty good points there, having been in that office for 8 years, but knows the weight of the office and the seriousness of it. And that is very true. I think few people, Democrats, of course, but, some Republicans, too, are like, yeah, no, he does. He doesn't at all feel the seriousness of the office.
That everyone, all the living ex-presidents, you heard from them this week. It was, you know, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter had a brief keynote. Bill Clinton had a speech Tuesday. Barack Obama had his speech last night. And, I mean, George W. Bush is not going to speak at the Democratic convention, but he's definitely not speaking at the Republican one either. So, you know, when you think about the overwhelming weight of the people who held that office, they are all on the Joe Biden side or are taking a powder or, you know, are registering their abstention with this election. And on the other side, you have Donald Trump. And they haven't announced the speakers list for the RNC next week yet, which I imagine we will talk about.
I saw the meme.
Week.
Yeah. Ted Nugent and Scott Baio.
And they've teased like Nikki Haley and Mike Pence. But they've also teased that smarmy kid from Covington and the crazy old couple who went out on their lawn with guns when the demonstrators went by.
Yeah, I don't know the name. The St. Louis gun people will be there.
Right.
And great pick.
The one Parkland parent who hasn't come out as anti-gun. That's the lineup they have next week. And on top of all that, too, the Democrats have been planning for this virtual convention since everything shut down in March. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's been banking on a real life in-person convention till like a month ago. So, I mean, there have been technical glitches with the DNC.
Yeah.
I don't know how the RNC is going to stack up in comparison considering they've been doing it on the fly.
Trump is pretty much just following them around, right? He was in Oshkosh and then what's Biden's hometown? He was there today, right?
So they're Scranton.
Yeah, so they're tailing each other.
Speaking of the office.
Yeah, speaking of the office. almost true to life. I don't know if any office people are going to be at the convention, but no, either one. Life is the office. So speaking of the office, we're going to shut the office for about 5 minutes here, play a couple of PSAs and announcements and some music. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Stay tuned for part two. If you're wondering in your Krusty the Clown voice, what the hell was that? Adam, I have some news for you, because guess what? We finally got Bob Bell on the show. That was Bob Bell, not the Guelph Bob Bell, but Bob Bell nonetheless, a re-release of his 1978 album Necropolis. And for the jazz listeners, whom I know we have a couple of you, people flip out about that album because it is so incredibly rare as, say, Bob Bell coming on this show. So there you go. It finally happened, Adam. So now we only need to worry about, no, I'm just, you know, Bit of an inside joke there, folks, but for regular listeners, I think they know exactly what I'm talking about. So we don't normally play jazz, but I know there's at least a couple of you there who are probably like, yes, tell me more about this album. Play the whole thing. Design a show around that album. Anyway, Bob Bell from the CFRU Remote Library. Fantastic. I don't know if this is going to be fantastic, though, that it was announced that on September 14th, New Brunswick will be having its, let's call it the pandemic election, just for the hell of it, because that's what's going on. It would seem that this is a minority government, a PC government, and they were in talks with the Liberals to come up with some kind of what they were calling a stability agreement. I don't think it was like a unity government by any means. It was kind of like, will you support us? And it fell apart completely with the Liberals saying, we pretty much, and I hate this old metaphor, but it was said that they felt that they had the gun to their head. So that was the end of that. So election called. And I'm pretty sure every party in opposition was like, we don't really want this. But at the same time, the wheels are rolling and you can't. It was weird because Premier Hicks did some kind of weird, like, oh, well, you know, we might be able to change it up or delay or cancel or modify it. But then, like, the lieutenant governor said, no, you know what? When you call the election, you have to have the election. It's kind of like, unless you made some laws that said you can hold it this way or that way, or you can vote on Zoom or whatever, which they didn't do, then it's just a regular run-of-the-mill election like they've been having from 1867. So he would say that, I think people were a little bit confused, but what is more confusing is how it's going to go. It would seem that the Conservatives aren't going to campaign door-to-door, at least that's what they've said. But I don't know. I think if other people are getting out there, then they may have to.
It's going to be curious. That's going to be the thing to watch is, like, how do you campaign in a pandemic? Because, I mean, campaigning is still so heavily dependent on door knocking. That's not the end all be all, of course. But that is where, you know, a lot of your campaign success or failure comes in is how much shoe leather you expend going out from door to door and meeting people face to face and getting people excited that way. It's going to depend on, frankly, stuff that is going to probably annoy a lot of people: phone calls, emails, social media posts,
DNC style convention in the middle of it, or, you know,
events and things. Like, you're not going to be having like big. I'm not sure how much of this is actually going to be traditional campaigning either, because, you know, campaigning is a lot of like, if we are elected, we're going to spend, you know, $23 billion on such and such initiative. And how much of that's going to be in this election when Blaine Higgs said that it's basically they're trying to get enough seats to have a government in a stable place that will then be able to govern the any kind of recovery from the pandemic or plan in the event of a resurgence of the pandemic. But the point of that, though, is that, you know, you can't really make a lot of hard and fast plans about the future. You can't say we're going to spend $50 billion over the next 5 years on, you know, making sure every roof in New Brunswick has a Canadian flag on it, because that would be kind of that's just pulling an idea out of my hat, but it would be like a superfluous waste of time when you don't know how much money you're going to have to spend in responding to the COVID crisis. How many, you know, we keep talking about a second wave, but could there be a third wave or a fourth wave or a fifth wave? We don't know. It's just going to be a really unusual campaign all around. And you're right about the other thing of it too, which is that it's really poor planning on Higgs's part, because he goes to the lieutenant general and says, hey, let's have an election. And the left general says, okay. And then he comes out and says, you know what, maybe we can have drive-through voting. And maybe we can have our voting machines outside. And maybe we can, you know, do this. And the chief electoral officer of New Brunswick is like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
You want to do that stuff, you have to change it in legislation through the Elections Act. And by the way, you just dissolved the legislature, so you can't change nothing until there's a legislature again.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to say the least. I'm not sure why he didn't just call the – there was some by-elections in the pipe, right?
There was at least two, yeah.
I think it was three because fairly sure that one of them was the former deputy premier, Robert Govan, mm-hmm. who had stepped. That wouldn't have been a by-election, but he defected to the Liberals, right?
Well, he resigned and then he defected.
And that was to do, what was the bill? He couldn't support one of the, a bill.
It was healthcare.
The hospital cuts. That's right. It was they had closed emergency wards and he's like, no. And then this Govan, who had defected, had described his old party as, quote, ice cold. That's gonna hurt a little bit, right? I mean, this is your, deputy premier, deputy premier was... I wanted to say deputy prime minister. All the deputies are getting the call up, the VPs and the deputies. That's how this what we're talking about this week. But so I guess with the failure of this agreement or cooperation agreement, whatever, we have this election
On top of that, too, though, there are four parties in the legislature in Brunswick. There's the PCs, there's the Liberals, there's the People's Alliance, which has been aligned with the PCs to this point.
They were propping them up, right?
Right.
Not officially, but just sort of. There's only three of them, is that right?
Well, there's also there's only three People's Alliance MPs or MLAs, and then there's the three Green Party MLAs.
Yes.
So even with the Liberals out, you still have 20 PC seats, three People's Alliance, three Greens. They could have continued with that, had their 26 seat coalition, which is just enough for a majority, because the seat count in New Brunswick is 49, and they could have proceeded from there. It really seems just all around Blaine Higgs just wasn't having it, and I don't know, I can't say for certain what was going on in his head, but it seems like there's a kind of attitude. We've only had 186 cases in New Brunswick, COVID cases, I mean.
Yeah.
I did look at the numbers before showtime. It is 186 total cases. They have 12 active cases right now, and they've only had two deaths. So perhaps there is a false sense of security. On the other hand, as we've seen with COVID, things can change very, very quickly, and they could be in the middle of an outbreak, in the middle of an election cycle, and they have absolutely no power to postpone that election, to stop the election and just go back to having the previous sitting government. Just all options are on the table. It's election or, I guess, chaos.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking about the by-elections, because they're traditionally low turnout for a by-election. This election itself, and it remains to be seen, but I think it will have a low turnout, lower than normal. What are they clocking in at about 60% these days? It's going to be way lower than that, especially if something is an outbreak or is in outbreak, like in the location of the polling stations or whatever. We don't know yet, right? But I believe they have a bit of an older population down there, so that too is problematic. And what provisions?
Well, the by-elections are also easier to control because they're select ridings. And in that circumstances, you could set something up and say, we're going to have internet voting in these three ridings because it's the pandemic, because these are special circumstances. We're going to go in and we're going to change the Election Act to say, under special circumstances like a state of provincial emergency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, internet voting will be allowed in municipalities holding a by-election. Bob's your uncle, Finn is your aunt. They could have done this. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could have scored three extra seats. Maybe not. But either way, then that gives you the tools to then, to think ahead. Just going election or nothing gives you no tools if there's a hiccup in the process, which there very well could be. It's just, really poor planning to call this thing and then start thinking about what other things you can do.
Yeah, and there was a ton of polls came out rather quickly there, so I think they've obviously been thinking about this, or the pollsters hit the phones right away. And it sounds like the two smaller parties, Greens and the People's Alliance, are on the rise. Like, they're expected to get more seats if the polls are anything to go by, and there was a bunch of them. But they didn't mention the fact that the NDP are pretty much a non-presence in New Brunswick. They have no seats currently. As to whether they could gain one or not, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like everything is covered down there in terms of, turf and territory. So
Well, it may be hubris too, because Higgs has gotten like a lot of premieres, has gotten good marks for how he's handled the pandemic. On the other hand, I was looking at the election numbers from 2018. The Liberals won the popular vote. It was kind of like as what happened in the federal election last year, where the opposition party got the most number of votes, but the governing party got the most number of seats. And I mean, it was also very close to that. I think the PCs got 22 seats versus 21 for the Liberals. On top of that, now you have the new Liberal leader, which is Kevin Vickers, who is a national name, regarded understandably by a lot of people as a hero because of what happened on Parliament Hill. I guess that was 2014 with the shooter.
Yeah.
He was the sergeant at arms. So, you know, Blaine Higgs stepped on, you know, he laid out a minefield, but he stepped out on a mine himself. And he has to hope that things kind of stay exactly as they are in New Brunswick. And people see him as the person who helped lead them through a really terrible crisis in a very good way. Because otherwise, as you said, what it seems like, at least from the polling, is that, you know, there could be more PC seats pulled off, or even more Liberal seats pulled off. But, you know, the real danger is for Higgs too. He's trying to pull the Theresa May to get that majority, and it could end up blowing up in his face, just like it did Theresa May, if the People's Alliance or the Greens or even the Liberals end up picking a couple more seats. The margin of error for him is very, very thin.
And sadly for them, it sounds like one of the bills that died was alcohol with takeout sales. So I think if anybody's going to need a drink during this election, they won't be able to get it. But minor point, I know, but it's New Brunswick. I think they still roll up the sidewalks on Sunday. But nice place. I haven't been in a long time, and probably won't be for a while. But speaking of not being somewhere for a while, it sounds like no one is going to be in the press gallery of the Alberta legislature at the rate they're going. There is a bit of a row going on between, and it's, this is what's weird about this story. Is it with the National Post or for the National Post? So maybe if you want to tell the story, Adam, about Rebel versus National Post versus press gallery versus whomever.
Sure. Yeah. Rebel Media, which everyone knows is kind of a far right outlet, which was started by Ezra Levant. They have, you know, they've applied to a lot of places to be part of the press gallery. They've applied numerous times to the House of Commons in Ottawa to be a member of the parliamentary press gallery there, and have been turned down. They did the same for the Alberta legislature to be let in the press gallery there. They were turned down. The new president who just took over, Tyler Dawson, he sent out an email that said, and I read the actual email, it said, I have been, just so everyone knows, I'm now the president of the Alberta Press Gallery. By the way, the two press passes that the Rebel has asked for Sheila Gunn-Reid and Keen Bext, I am not endorsing those, and they will not be allowed in the press gallery. And then after that, Post Media said that they will be pulling all the reporters for their newspapers out of the Alberta Legislature Press Gallery, which, as you implied, pretty much empties the press gallery, except for the local CBC and CTV people, because all the four biggest papers in Alberta, the two in Calgary, the two in Edmonton, are all Post Media papers. And I should note that Tyler Dawson is the National Post reporter for the Alberta legislature. The current president of the press gallery works for the National Post, which is a Post Media paper.
Yes.
So he can't go to work as the president of the press gallery.
Yeah, so it's one of those conflict of interest things, sort of. It's like, okay, it happens to be that paper is the head of it. They're denying passes to the Rebels. I know I've said this before, but I only really look at, I'm not sure how often you look at Rebel. I only look at it when we talk about it generally, unless there's something going on. And of those, the two people you named, of course, the great question out of this is, who is a journalist, right? Mm-hmm. And we know that journalism isn't a regulated profession, although in my opinion it should be, and the line as to who decides who is an actual journalist is a bit fluid. The problem with Rebel, as we know, is that they are so, I guess you'd say reactionary, right? In terms of the way they deliver news, there's no nuance. It's pure right-leaning bias. I've never seen anything else coming from them. When I've seen stuff from them, there is news and then there is opinion, and they are pure opinion passing as news, but they're also kind of litigious, right? They're like, we'll sue your butt for stuff like this. Like, are they suing the National Post because of this?
No, the Post is on the Rebel side, so they're not. I don't think they've sued anybody. The people they would have to sue is the legislature, because the Alberta legislature gives power to the membership of the press gallery to enforce who gets in and who doesn't get in.
So it's up to them. Like, it's up to the legislature itself, right?
Technically, the legislature empowers the press gallery to, I guess, quote unquote, police itself. But I mean, it's also ultimately the legislature gives them that power. So, I mean, a similar thing happened in 2016. I mean, this is kind of already well-worn ground for the Alberta legislature, because Rachel Notley's government tried to bar a Rebel reporter from covering the legislature.
Reporter, air quotes, back to the air quotes, reporter. Yeah. Right.
But I mean, understandable. The Rebels, you know, the Rebel media was one of the loudest people, almost literally calling for Rachel Notley's head for crimes against oil. Her government, the Notley government, the legislature, said that this person wasn't allowed in, and they had a whole commission to sort of outline the rights and responsibilities of the press gallery and who gets to be admitted, and it was found that that power lies only with the press gallery itself, as given power by the Speaker of the Legislature.
So the Post reporters are out in solidarity, supposedly in Alberta, but yet in Ottawa, and I can't remember who pointed this out, that there's still like 10 Post and Post-related reporters in the press gallery there, and the Rebel are definitely not allowed in Ottawa. Isn't that right?
No, that's right. And of course, you know, very famously, Keen Brext.
That's the kid, right? The kid that was involved with the Fash website, who is a reporter in air quotes. Well, that was his hobby, right? Or something, that he was selling fascist materials. And he is supposedly a reporter and a journalist of some kind. And I have a problem with that. He might be a blogger and he might be somebody with opinions, but he's no journalist, right?
Right. Yeah.
In the classic sense of report the news, kid. Rather than, seriously though, right?
You're not wrong, but because he was the kid who was led away by the RCMP from Rideau Hall, and he tried to go into one of Justin Trudeau's press conferences, and you know, he was led away, you know, by the RCMP, and he's like, you know, they were trying to see my phone. This is an outrage. And
I feel like Gore Vidal is a little crypto fascist, but it's, you know, that in my opinion. I'll make clear that it's my opinion rather than say, you know, like.
I don't disagree with any of that. I confess, though, and I've said this before on the show, that Rebel Media being able to publish what it wants is the only way I know I can publish what I want. And they can say all kinds of hateful things within reason, because we do have hate crime laws in this country. But the onus is on the people to understand their biases and what they're selling. And we do a very bad job about media literacy in this country.
Yes, very true.
And the flip side of this too is, I don't think Rebel Media really wants to be let in to any press gallery anywhere. They want to be banned.
Yeah, that's how they get the press that they want. So they get eyes on the page. So you'll look at the art, you know.
The only reason Keen Brext goes to Rideau Hall is so that the RCMP will throw him out. And he knows it. And Ezra Levant knows it too, because get that video, you take that video, you put it on Facebook, you send it out in an email, you say, this is
I'm
how
so repressed. Yeah.
The Trudeau government treats a free press. What are you going to do about it? And of course, what are you going to do about it means sending us your money, sending us your email, so then that we can send you another email in the future so that maybe that time you can send us money. They want to be banned because that's their fundraising model.
Yeah,
oh, banned equals money.
Yeah. And get people all red-faced, usually white males, and, ah, my rights. But, yeah, this is one of the differences as I see it, though. And I get your point about you saying because the rebel does what they do, that you can do what you do. And, again, it comes back to who is a reporter and journalist, which, in my opinion, you are. I mean, I don't even consider myself. Right. You know this, that I don't consider myself a reporter. I'm more of like a – not even I mean, I have put it this way. I've reported on things for the station and done interviews, but does that make me I kind of like the way they put it in the UK, a presenter more than anything. Right. And then, of course, I do technical things around here, and then we share opinions every week. And we've been doing this for a very, very long time. And people have referred to me as a journalist, and I wouldn't say no. Like I feel sort of like, oh, I'm a journalist. Oh. Get gushy about it rather. You know this. You are a journalist. You're accepted at the press gallery downtown. You know, there's no one. Occasionally online, somebody would say that guy's not a real journalist. Or that back and forth that we had about the you're not a member of the Canadian Media Guild, which I am. So I don't know. Does that, because I have a union card, does that automatically make me a journalist? I don't know. And I would still put the rebels, in that category where it's like, sure, you're people with an opinion and you can write pretty much what you want, although they have been sued many, many times for things that they have said that have just been completely out to lunch and off the wall. Is that journalism? I don't think so. I mean, is every you know, nut bar with a little card that says press? Because then you can do a pretty good-looking one. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple from CFRU and just walked into things. One was the Green Party at the Metro Convention Center. You know, I said CFRU, and I literally walked in the middle of it and was holding the mic to Elizabeth May. So I guess it depends on where that line is drawn as well. But I don't know. Maybe things would have been different if I had one that said rebel, because, oh, get them, you know, right?
I mean, that's the kind of the journalistic utopia we want. And I think it's a very recent thing to think of the press with a capital P. I mean, you go back 100 years, there were always partisan outfits. If you were a rich guy with money to burn, or maybe an axe to grind, you would start a newspaper. It was just kind of what you did. And, you know,
and that still happens too, right? Like Sinclair,
absolutely,
in the U.S. and
Amazon. I mean,
I would even say the
Jeff
Post.
Jeff Bezos is a guy with $1 trillion. So what is he going to spend it on?
The Bezos Washington Post, as Trump calls it.
Well, exactly. And, you know,
I got a bunch of money. What should I do? Yeah,
it's, you know, yeah, I think it's more a matter of the public to understand what goes into creating a journalism outfit. If you just republish press releases and sort of aggregate press releases and you call yourself a news site, is that journalism? Perhaps. I mean, it does take, you know, you do have to be able to go to all these places, sort of know where to find this information or arrange it so that it is emailed to you. That's not necessarily, I mean, I know it doesn't sound like a lot of work, but it can be work to sort of get yourself on the radar of like, when you think of all the different institutions in a city, that is a lot of work. On the other hand, there is the work of reporting, which is what I do when I go to city council and I'm tweeting. I am reporting on what is going on, or even just when I'm sitting in my home office watching city council on my computer. The act of like reporting and offering insight or links to further information, or where this piece of information came from, or longstanding grudges and things that are having influence on the debate. That is reporting. And I again, it's not up to the government to decide if I'm a journalist. It is up to people to understand what I do is different from what Jerry Barker in town does, or what Rebel Media does, or even what Press Progress does, which is one outlet we haven't touched upon here, but it's part of the Broadbent Institute, former NDP leader Ed Broadbent. So they definitely have an editorial slant. But is that to say that they're not breaking legitimate journalistic stories? No, of course not, because they have, and they probably will again.
Well, we'll definitely come back to this topic for sure, and if anybody out there wants to send us their millions and billions so we can keep doing what we're doing, CFRU.ca, or actually, you could probably send it to, I'm probably not supposed to solicit this, but Adam, where can the millionaires and billionaires reach you if they want to find out more about what you do?
I have a convenient links on Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca, or you can tweet at me, Adam A. Donaldson, on Twitter.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find me, us, here every Friday at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph and on various other shows, including the end credits, and just here, there, and everywhere. We are around. So anyway, join us next week for another exciting round of this show, and I better get going, so we'll talk to you soon. Till next week, à la prochaine.